On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the 1990s, when China's fabled Shaolin Temple was celebrating its 1500th anniversary as a center of Zen Buddhism and Kung Fu, American college student Matthew Polly was on a pilgrimage of his own. The skinny kid from Topeka, Kansas, who had grown up on Star Wars and David Carradine, was leaving Princeton University to look for courage and spiritual guidance. He went to Shaolin, deep in central China, to study Kung Fu as martial art and spiritual practice. What he found was a legend decimated under Mao, reborn as tourist trap and kung fu paradise. He also found fighting monks a rich cultural icon and the courage he was looking for. Up next on Point, American Shaolin. Joining me today from New York is Matthew Polly. He left Princeton University after his junior year to spend 2 years studying kung fu in Shaolin. He came back to win a Rhodes Scholarship. He's now travel writer for Slate.com. His new book is American Shaolin. Matthew Polly, thanks a lot for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's quite a story. There's a big personal story here and also a deep cultural story. I wish you'd take us back just to set the table for us. Give us the history of this place. Where is Shaolin? It sounds like a fable. You remind us. It's for real. Give us the history going way back, 492 A.D., as you describe it.
Yes. 492 A.D., there was a Buddhist monk named Damo who was a favorite of the emperor's, but he didn't like living in the imperial city, which at that time was Luoyang. And so the emperor built him a small monastery up in the mountains, and they named it Shaolin, which means a small forest, because there was a small forest surrounding it. And over the next 100 years or so, the Shaolin Temple went from becoming just an isolated monastery to the center of Kung Fu and what would later be known in Japanese as Zen Buddhism.
How does it happen that Kung Fu fighting and Zen Buddhism get braided together here in the Song Mountains at Shaolin?
That is the most fascinating kind of historical question about the Shaolin Temple. The most prevalent theory is that Zen Buddhism started as pure sitting meditation. The idea was that the only way to achieve enlightenment wasn't through good works or merit. The idea to achieve enlightenment was through sitting meditation and actually achieve a moment of satori, a breakthrough. But the monks soon found, like many office workers, that sitting in it all day long turns your muscles into mush. So they introduced some calisthenic exercises, and these became part of the practice, and they became a sort of moving meditation. At the same time, China was going through a very rough historical period. There were a lot of warlords and bandits. And so the theory is that some of the monks became guards of the temple. And those guards started to turn the calisthenic exercises into a form of fighting. And the combination of the two is what created Kung Fu. So it's both an art form and a form of meditation and a way to defend yourself.
And then in that rough period of history you described, there's the evil warlord Wang Shichong and the Tang prince Li Ximin. Their interaction of the Shaolin monks and this prince leads to their special status. Remind us of the story.
That is the classic beginning story for the Shaolin Temple. That's really where they become the heroes of China. What happened was a warlord, China had split into half, and one of the warlords vying for power seized a young prince who would later become the Tang Emperor. And he also made the mistake of burning down the Shaolin Temple. So, and according to the legend, 13 of the Shaolin monks went and rescued the Tang prince and restored him to power, defeated the warlord. And when the Tang prince became the first emperor of Tang China, he rewarded the Shaolin Temple by rebuilding it, expanding its land holdings, and giving them special dispensations that no other Buddhist monastery enjoyed, which included eating meat and drinking alcohol.
So these became very earthy monks, fighting and kicking and punching and meat-eating booze drinkers.
Exactly. They did have to keep their vow of celibacy. So in many ways, he had a celibate force of warriors who also had a strict religious upbringing, but there's that interesting tension between Buddhism, which is nonviolent and passive, and of course, Kung Fu, which is certainly not.
There's a lot of legend here, but history too. One thing clearly, Japan was affected by Shaolin. Remind us of that link.
Well, in the 11th and 12th century, Japanese monks went over to the Shaolin Temple and studied what was in Chinese called Chan Buddhism and Kung Fu. And over the years, they brought it back to Japan and changed the name to Zen and combined what we have learned about the archery, the swordsmanship, the karate, with this idea of Zen Buddhism. So in many ways, Japanese culture up until the Meiji period was truly a Shaolin culture. You could almost consider the island an extension of the Shaolin Temple in the sense of its cultural background.
Now, of course, China also seen as a birthplace of an awful lot of martial arts. You describe this kind of competition here, your Wu-Tang clan and your Shaolin gang. Remind us of those two threads.
Throughout Chinese religious history and political history, there's been a competition between Taoism on one hand and Buddhism on the other. And so you would have a Taoist emperor build up a bunch of temples and knock down a bunch of Buddhist temples, and then you would have a Buddhist emperor rise to power and do the opposite. So the Wu-Tang temple was essentially the Taoist rival to the Shaolin temple, which was Buddhist. And so the Wu-Tang clan, which we know from music, got their influence from that aspect of the culture. So in China, Kung Fu was started at the Shaolin Temple, but there's millions of different styles that have flowed out of it.
But some fundamental differences that you describe in between the sort of Taoist-rooted Kung Fu and the Buddhist-rooted Kung Fu.
That is one of the interesting aspects. The Taoists don't have as much respect for nonviolence or life as the Buddhist teaching have. So the Shaolin monks were known for their staff because it was a non-bladed weapon and you could knock someone out without killing them, whereas the Taoists were known for their sword. And so there's a saying about Shaolin staff, Wu-Tang sword. And it bases the difference on the difference in philosophy between the two religious practices.
But the Shaolin comes to hold an incredibly powerful place in Chinese legend and iconography and cultural understanding, so powerful that to fast forward the tape tremendously here through the centuries, by the time Mao Zedong comes on the scene looking for a revolution of his own, he's very wary of the fighting Buddhist monks here. Why, and what did he do about it?
Well, one of the things that happened throughout Shaolin's history is it became a center for rebellion against what was considered to be foreign occupiers. So when the Manchus took over during the Qing dynasty, Shaolin was a hotbed of revolt. And Mao Zedong was well aware of this history, and he wanted to eliminate in many ways the feudal past of China and create a new China, this socialist ideal. So he considered Kung Fu itself and the Shaolin Temple in particular and all of Buddhism and all religion as a threat. So amazingly enough, during the 1950s, he tried to ban all Kung Fu, which is a little like trying to ban, you know, high school football in West Texas.
How did that work out for Shaolin itself?
Well, it was difficult for Shaolin during that period. A number of monks had to go underground, and the worst occurred during the Cultural Revolution, which was almost an attempted suicide. The Shaolin monks were run off. The ones who stayed were thrown in jail, imprisoned. From 1966 to 1976, the Shaolin Temple was essentially abandoned.
So then to fast forward once more, we come to 1981. China's opening up a bit. Mao is gone. And you end up with a movie, the Shaolin movie with Jet Li, and it reminds us of how that just breaks open the Shaolin story again for China and the world.
Well, it's amazing because it's a case of art imitating life and life imitating art. The cultural reformers under Deng Xiaoping were looking for a way to make money fast, and one of the best ways is tourism. And so they worked together with the Hong Kong company to create a movie called The Shaolin Temple, which is based on the story of the 13 monks who rescued the first Tang Emperor. And they looked around China for someone to star in the movie, and Jet Li at the time was 17 years old, and he was a five-time national champion, and he was the star of Wushu. So they made him the star of this movie, and it became mainland China's first blockbuster. And it had such an impact that tens of thousands of young boys ran away from home and ran to the Shaolin Temple. So many so that the Chinese government itself had to build special trains to try to return some of them. But martial artists in the area, some of the Shaolin monks realized there was an opportunity here, and so schools started to build. There were 10,000 students there, and it basically gave rebirth to the temple.
And way off in Topeka, Kansas, one very young at that point, 98-pound weakling, as you described yourself at that point, Matthew Polly, begins to feel the call of this very distant and I guess in Kansas, pretty exotic allure.
The big moment for me was seeing David Carradine in Kung Fu, in which he was Kane, the half-Chinese, half-Western Shaolin monk who had committed a crime in China and came to the West and tried to right wrongs. And I saw in him something that I wanted to be. You know, when you're 12 or 13, you take on these sort of fantasy idols. And I always had in my head this idea of being a Shaolin monk or a Shaolin master. And it wasn't until college that I actually realized that the Shaolin Temple truly existed. I thought it was just a mythical place.
Right. Matthew Polly is with us. His new book is American Shaolin. Left Princeton after his junior year, went off 2 years whacking and getting whacked and learning the inside out of the legendary, fabled, and historic Shaolin. He says he was inspired in part by the 1972 TV series Kung Fu. David Carradine there played a Shaolin monk who wandered America's Wild West, dispensing justice with his Kung Fu skills. Here's a little bit of that. A Shaolin master addressing Carradine and another junior monk.
Disciple Kane, disciple Lin Wu, you are both excellent young men. Your masters are well pleased. You have both learned so well that it is hard to choose between you. However, a choice must be made. It is the Shaolin way that only one may step upward into the mysteries of the order at this time. It lies between you two.
There you go. The masters are well pleased in 1972 with Kung Fu. Listeners, how do you think about Kung Fu? If you think about it at all, B-movie silliness, serious martial art, cultural artifact, what do you make of the braided history of Kung Fu and Zen Buddhism? What do you make, and we'll hear a lot more of it, of Matthew Polly's story. We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Matthew Polly, lots of people dream about setting off for that kind of wild. It's kind of been done. You write that Mark Salzman's journey that he wrote about in Iron and Silk kind of a decade or more before you got going was part of what inspired you. But give us the personal recipe that got you aimed at the Chinese hinterlands in Shaolin.
Well, one of the, I think, deeper reasons I was interested in it is because I was, as we talked about before, a classic 98-pound weakling, the kind of scrawny kid the bullies love to hate. So when I was young, I kind of dreamed about being able to defend myself and never felt like I could. And so in a way, in my head, I had this idea that if I went to the granddaddy of all Chinese martial arts monasteries and learned from the greatest masters on earth, that I would be able to kind of overcome this internal fear.
You say you were a glass-half-empty type of guy. You had your own what's-wrong-with-things-that-are-wrong-with-Matt list. Ignorant, cowardly, still a boy, not a man, unattracted to the opposite sex, spiritually confused, it might have read you right when you were 15.
That's exactly right. I don't think I'm the only one who has that list. I may just be the one who's most explicit
down.
About it. So in a way, it's a kind of to-do list for self-improvement. And what I wanted to do was, figure out a way to make myself better and correct the things that I thought I was weak at. Ignorant was one of them. And so that was the reason I studied very hard and ended up going to Princeton. And once I'd been able to or felt that I could scratch that off my list, cowardly was the next one. And so in my mind, going to Princeton, you go to a venerable institution and you get rid of being ignorant. If you want to get rid of cowardly, well, you should go to another venerable institution that is good at turning scrawny young boys into tough fighters. And the Shaolin Temple is the most venerable one in the world. So it made perfect sense to me. It didn't make any sense to my parents or most of my friends. But when you have an inner voice tell you what to do, sometimes you just have to listen to it.
Now, we have to understand the moment, China's moment, when you arrived there. You've been back recently, but this was before the full flowering of China's prosperity and dynamic economy that we've seen recently. It was the early 90s when you set off for Shaolin. Tiananmen and the killings there were still resonating in China. And Shaolin, well, describe it when you arrived.
Exactly. Tiananmen had a big impact on China itself, and also the perception of China as being a backward place, a very repressive, poor country, a lot like North Korea, only with better hairdos and food. Mm-hmm. But the Shaolin Temple itself was just starting to open up. And when I arrived, I expected the windswept monastery that you imagine when you watch the movies or you imagine in your head. And what it turned out to be was a sort of tacky tourist trap. It was Kung Fu world. There were dragon cars driving around, peasants selling tchotchkes. You could go see Mao's first plane. You could see a mummy if you paid the entrance fee. So it really was a kind of third world Kung Fu Epcot center. And the monks themselves were in many ways prisoner to the success as a tourist attraction. They would try to remain hidden during the day when all the tourists were there. They often wouldn't wear robes because if they did, they were harassed walking down the street. So when I first arrived, I couldn't find the monks. I was searching around this little village.
Where are the
with
monks?
All these,
where are the monks? Where,
I've come all this way. I found the temple, and there are no monks here.
And because of Mao and the Cultural Revolution, the fighting monks who were there were not old. They were not much older than you.
Exactly. The first group of monks came in 1981. So and they were 10 or 11 years old when they arrived. So the vast majority of the monks were about 17, 18, 19, 20, and there were only two or three monks who had survived the Cultural Revolution. So there was a huge generational gap between the two.
So here was the tourist trap. You were right in the middle of it. But when they did bust out all their skills, it was quite something to see. I wish you'd read a little bit from your book, American Shaolin, about when the guys got revved up for performance.
Shaolin's only truly interesting entertainment option was the monks' spectacular kung fu performances. There was no set schedule for them. They might not perform for several days, and then suddenly have three afternoon performances with an evening blowout. Tour operators would call at the last minute, hoping to get a better deal on the ticket prices. Or some government officials would appear with some foreign dignitaries they wanted to impress with the Chinese cultural event. Or a group would just show up at the door with a person in tow owed a favor by someone at the temple, and the monks had to drop what they were doing and put on a show. The performances were designed like a superior version of the regular workout. The monks began with some jumping, leaping, and other gymnastic flips and falls across the mat. The youngest and least talented would start with basic leaping kicks. The difficulty of the techniques would ratchet up with each succeeding monk until the most talented concluded the warm-up, most often either Monk De Qing with a series of whirling high kicks, or Monk Li Peng, a taciturn loner who could do 20 back handsprings on the space the size of a dinner table. After limbering up, the monks would execute the stretching kicks with military precision, each back ramrod straight, every knee and elbow locked, every foot touching the top of every forehead, every leg snapping up and down almost faster than the eye could follow. Once this group warm-up was complete, the monks left the room to return one by one to perform their individual specialties. These broke down into two groups, forms and qigong skills. Most of the qigong skills were iron kung fu feats. The Chinese believe in a concept called qi, which roughly translates as vitality or breath or energy. They believe that qi courses through the human body like the Force in Star Wars. And this qi can be strengthened through breathing exercises and then focused to various parts of the body. Iron kung fu involves directing the qi to a part of the body to protect it from a blow. One monk was an expert in iron arm and iron leg kung fu. During the performance, various wooden staves were broken over his limbs. A monk who specialized in iron stomach kung fu invited members of the audience to punch him as hard as they could. The blows had no observable effect. His facial expression never changed. Another monk broke bricks over his head.
And off we go. That's Matthew Polly reading from his new book, American Shaolin. And I should say, by the way, at our website, onpointradio.org, you can get a link to Matthew's where you can see clips of the action in Shaolin, photographs of quite extraordinary scene there. Matthew, you take us right there with your reading. A lot of listeners want to speak to you. Let me begin to turn to them, if I may. In Lansing, Michigan, Apachu joins us. Hi, Apachu. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
The only thing I can resort to is my readings, and like you, I was excited about the idea of learning how to fight as a youth, and I did a lot of readings on the martial arts, which embraced many different fighting forms. But my understanding of the Sholin Temple was that when you entered there, you entered a place of secrecy, number one. Number two, a prerequisite to learning was that of not having an ego. But, and no disrespect, sir, but here you are profiteering and revealing as a result of your adventures and so forth. Am I incorrect, or how do you justify that, or could you please respond to that? And thank you, sir.
Thank you. Sure. Matthew Pauley?
Sure, that's a great question. That's the kind of mythical version of the Shaolin Temple, and maybe it was like that a long time ago. When I arrived, the Shaolin Temple was controlled by the Hunan Communist Party, and they were interested in making as much money as possible. So you didn't actually enter a secretive place. You entered a back room with a Communist Party official who told you, if you have $1,000, you can train with the Shaolin monks. So in that sense, it had become thoroughly capitalistic. The other issue that you talk about with profiteering is the reason I wrote this book is because the abbot of the Shaolin Temple asked me to. He wanted to do something to help promote Shaolin in the West, and he had felt that Shaolin had fallen behind Japan and Korea's Taekwondo and Karate during the Cultural Revolution, and he was very interested in spreading Shaolin culture. So in many ways, writing this book was out of a favor to the abbot of the Shaolin Temple, who is my master there.
And what about the spiritual aspect that we're asked about there, go with no ego? Was this all about punching, kicking, and twirling the big stick, or was there still a spiritual practice as an important part of it?
There was definitely a spiritual practice that was taken on there. There was meditations in the morning and the evening. But at the time, they were mostly interested in how to make money, the government was, and kung fu performances were the way to do that. Tourists don't come and pay to watch monks sit in silent meditation. They want to see the flashy stuff. So there's always been a tension between the spiritual side and the martial side, and while I was there, the martial side was more predominant. But slowly over time, when I returned, I found that the spiritual side has been growing. But there's certainly that aspect. You would like to be without ego, but that is, if one achieves that, one's already the Buddha. I'm certainly not.
Matthew Pauley's new book is American Shaolin. I want to turn for just a moment, if we may, Matthew, to a Kung Fu Grand Master. He joins us from Santa Monica, California. Spends a lot of time taking Americans to China to study martial arts. Eric Lee is with us, a 40-year veteran of martial arts. He owns Eric Lee's Academy for the Martial Arts, has an annual martial arts tour to mainland China. Eric Lee, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on the air.
So tell us about, Matthew Pauley put his hand up and went to Shaolin already in the early 90s. These days, when Americans sign up with you to go to China and study martial arts, what's the kind of person who does it? Is it young people, young men, and what are they looking for in China?
Well, first of all, before I say anything, I want to thank you for Matthew Pauley and for his contribution. I think he gave a very excellent history of the Shaolin Temple. I'm grateful for his experience, and a lot of listeners listen to his experience. Mm. It's excellent. As far as going to China, it's a way of, first of all, people in the United States, we work a lot of hours, and a lot of people has never explored to the country like China, and a lot of people actually are afraid to go. But the China now is opening so much, they're receptive to there are a lot of people to visit and enrich the soul and spirit and from the experience of the tour. I started this tour 2004, and then this is my third time going, except this time we're including Hawaii. Now, all kinds of people are interested in. I have other grandmasters from different systems of the martial art. I have beginners of the students just start training, they're fascinated by the Shaolin Temple, which is it's legendary. You know, it's being there is like the real thing. Made a lot of people dreams come true. And then also Bodhi Lama that Paulie mentioned earlier, they have a cave and we can climb up the cave and a really tough walk, really. And then I visited that with among the other martial artists and last tour, and we'll probably do that again this one.
Is this the cave where the first abbot, Damo, sat and meditated until his outline was burned into the cave wall?
Yes.
In legend, anyway?
He is considered the father of Kung Fu. And even today, a lot of people still worship and celebrate his birthday.
And Chinese Kung Fu today, do you see it as just one more martial art, or is it somehow fundamentally different?
Shaolin is a big branch of the tree. There are many systems underneath there, and they flourish throughout the world. It has a really long history, and it's a great way to start training.
Matthew Polly, can you hear Grandmaster Eric Lee fitting right into the Shaolin scene now, or is he interpreting for American ears here? Does he speak about Shaolin Kung Fu in the same way that the monks you knew and know there do?
No, I think he's absolutely right. The monks respected all different styles of Kung Fu, and they enjoyed them, and they often would study with other instructors. Their feeling was that Shaolin is the birthplace, so it is the main trunk of the tree, and everything branches off from it. And I think Master Lee is exactly right.
Let me take a call from Virginia Beach. Virginia, Paul, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I've got a question for your guest. Based on his experience and based on that rich cultural history of China, what is the mentality of today's China looking at the Western world and specifically to our country, to the United States of America, and how how they are related to that old rich cultural history on their mentality of today's?
And particularly maybe the kind of Shaolin perspective. Matthew Polly, is there something core here to Chinese culture? You hear Paul's question. How does it affect the way they see the world now? Us too.
Well, I think the thing I found most fascinating about China, or one of the many things, was they have such a strong sense of national pride. And pride in their long history and culture, of which the Shaolin Temple represents one of the great cultural achievements to give the world Kung Fu and Zen Buddhism. So, in many ways, their interest in America was an interest in how they could become as rich and strong as America was, so that they would once again get the respect that they felt they deserved, and in many ways had lost during the 20th century. So. They really wanted to spread their culture so that other people could see what was great about China and feel the strength of this new China.
Eric Lee, do you hear that pride? Do you feel it when you take your Americans to visit China these days?
Yes, I hear that. You know, actually, with my experience, they love to learn from each other. And actually, these all-American tourists, martial artists and non-martial artists as well, they love to learn from the Chinese culture, and then vice versa.
Eric Lee, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're talking this hour about a journey to the heart of China's Kung Fu culture with Matthew Polly. His new book is American Shaolin, Flying Kicks, Buddhist Monks, and the Legend of Iron Crotch. We'll have to ask about that. And what does the mystique of Shaolin tell us about China these days, and maybe ourselves? Of course, the movies have put that mystique in our heads for a long time. Here's a little bit from The Great One, Bruce Lee, in the 1971 TV series Longstreet, The Way of the Intercepting Fist. Here Bruce Lee gives an American student words of martial arts wisdom.
Empty your mind. Be formless, shapeless, like water. Now you put water into a cup, it becomes the cup. Put it into a teapot, it becomes the teapot. Now water can flow or creep or drip or crash. Be water, my friend.
Be water, my friend. Callie is calling from Suffolk, Virginia. Hi, Callie. You're on the air with Matthew Polly.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is a really interesting conversation as a yoga practitioner for 12 years, I hear a lot of similarities between Kung Fu and the practice of yoga, and yet as people outside of the practice observe it, it's always diluted down to the physical strength or discipline, and yet I'm assuming there's a strong spiritual and mental component that your guest had to go through as well. Shaolin apparently beginning in the root of meditation and how to keep the body healthy so that it can sit for long periods of time. The deeper work comes in that time, and so I'd like to ask your guest, as he practiced the mental and spiritual disciplines and learned more about himself, his limitations, how he sees the world, and things that get in between him and being a pure conduit for chi or spirit or whatever they call it, how has he taken this into himself, integrated it, and then come back into society? I'm constantly humbled and overwhelmed by my own battle with which illusion I want to subscribe to, and just being a human being also. It's hard to be a spiritual being and a human being, and I hope he can understand where I'm coming from and what I'm asking of him.
Kelly, let us pick it up. Matthew Polly, yoga asks of Kung Fu, and you hear the shape of Kelly's question.
I do. I know exactly where she's coming from. That is one of the difficult things, is trying to be in the world but also be of the spirit. I personally found that Kung Fu, at its most basic level, is a fighting form, and that's what interests sort of young boys. And those are where we watch the movies, the flashy moves. But it's really started as a form of moving meditation. And so as I did the Kung Fu forms there, there were moments where it felt almost like a mystical experience. So in many ways, the practice of it is a kind of religious practice. And so for me, I try to I keep up the practice as much as I can, given all the demands that there are when you are away from a monastery and back in the world here.
And yet, Matthew Polly, we heard in that Bruce Lee clip, you know, it's so easy to see that as a kind of a send-up of culture, a kind of, you know, be the teapot. Do you see Western culture exoticizing the Shaolin teaching? Do the Chinese themselves turn it into something exotic and distant or something to incorporate in daily life?
Well, the Chinese are absolutely in love with Kung Fu. You can see it being practiced everywhere. I do think that the Western culture has a tendency first to exoticize it and then to parody the exotic nature of it. The truth of the matter is it's a normal practice just the same way as going to churches over here. It's not considered to be something particularly exotic. And the other important thing I wanted to bring out in the book was that those who practice it are as human as anyone else. They're wonderful martial artists. They are spiritual people. But they have the same flaws that we all do. And one of the difficulties is assuming that somehow these are perfect beings, when that really reduces from their achievement if you don't recognize their humanity.
Let's go to Marin in Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Marin. You're on the air with Matthew Polly.
Hello. How are you doing?
Well, fine. What do you know, Marin?
Okay. Well, I lived in China for a few years, and I'm fairly fluent in Chinese.
Good for you.
I studied traditional Tai Chi Chuan, Chen-style Tai Chi Chuan in China,
mm-hmm.
with a family member of the Chen family, and I just wanted to make some comments about Mr. Polly's statements about Kung Fu and Shaolin, etc.
Let's hear it.
Well, to start with, Chinese Kung Fu did not originate from Shaolin. It's more of a way station. There's a lot of other forms of Chinese Kung Fu in China besides Shaolin that predate, their roots predate what is known now as Shaolin Kung Fu. A lot of Shaolin Kung Fu now is really what we would call performance wushu, which is not exactly traditional fighting forms. And I'm curious to know what level of Chinese language experience Mr. Polly has and what Kung Fu experience and research he might have had or done before he went to China, because when I was there, I'll tell you, I saw a lot of Westerners studying Chinese Kung Fu who really just didn't know anything about what they were searching for before they went, and what they ended up training was not, they thought it was probably very traditional, but it was really not.
Matthew Polly, Mara's kind of calling you out here. We have Fist of Fury flying soon, but how do you respond?
That's a great question. I think we'll get into some of it with the next reading. But he's quite right. There's a great deal of wushu. I knew
this
some
is the
of the
more performance style that Mao promoted.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I knew many of the Chen stylists while I was there. Chen style Tai Chi also started in Henan province. Mm. One of the things you find within the martial arts community is there are often a lot of arguments about the origins, as there are with all sort of practices. And mm-hmm. so different people have different opinions. I found as at Princeton, I was an East Asian studies major, a Buddhism expert, and someone who was fluent in Chinese. So I knew quite a bit about it before I went there and did quite a bit of research. So when I say that the Shaolin Temple is the origins, that's the commonly assumed theory. There are others who have disagreements, and I certainly respect those views. And modern Shaolin Kung Fu has been influenced by all the other styles. It's very eclectic, and it grows over time, and we don't really know what it was originally like. But I stand by my expertise on this subject.
Okay, outside. Later, Marin. Marin, thank you very much for calling. Rick's calling from Bridgeport, Connecticut. Hi, Rick, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Tom. How's everybody?
Everyone's pretty well. The fists aren't flying yet. What do you know, Rick?
Well, I'm a professor at the Martial Arts Studies Department at the University of Bridgeport.
Great.
Which is the only college in America with a Martial Arts Studies degree.
Yeah.
I'm also a columnist for Inside Kung Fu magazine. I just wanted to hopefully illuminate what has been said. I find your guest to be very, very balanced, very moderate in his views, which is excellent because that's really what Kung Fu is all about. It's a balance between the external, which you could say the performance or the aggression, and the internal, which is considered the spiritual. Mm. So when you create a balance that's 50-50, not 60% external or 40% internal, then you have very powerful Kung Fu. Kung Fu is also excellent in terms of the ability to hurt or destroy or defend yourself comes as a side effect to a technique or a process which allows you to become happy, healthy, and wise. So that's the glory. That's what's in it for Americans today. Speaking of America, I wanted your guest's opinion on the schools of Shaolin Kung Fu that have been created in the New York area. There's an official satellite of the Shaolin Temple, I believe, in Queens, New York, which he discovered, of course, that it's basically an Epcot in China. You can actually learn Shaolin Kung Fu from Shaolin monks in Queens, and there's a renegade Shaolin USA temple in Manhattan. Did your guests know about these?
Wow, well, way inside Kung Fu. It gets curiouser and curiouser. Matthew Polly?
Yes, Guo Lin and Yan Ming are the two monks he's referring to. They defected to the United States in 1992, right before I went to the Shaolin Temple. And I've met both of them, and I know both of them. And they're both representatives in their own ways of the Shaolin Temple, Shaolin Kung Fu, and Shaolin culture. And I'll just be diplomatic and say that the internal politics of Shaolin, as it's practiced here in the States, is a subject probably for another discussion.
But it sounds like it could be a deep one. And, Rick, we're grateful for your call. Matthew, maybe one more reading, maybe the third one that we marked out here, where one of your teachers, De Ching, I believe it is,
yes,
puts on quite a display. Li Peng, who you mentioned, was great, but De Ching, well, read it for us.
Okay. Monk De Ching's entire body was basically one fast-twitch muscle. His endurance was lacking, but for the minute or so he was in front of the crowd, he was an explosion of kinetic motion. He was so fast and so strong that he couldn't be bothered with the niceties of wushu forms, which require the feet, the hands, the head, and the body to be exactly a certain way at exactly a certain moment. He was too busy blowing through the form, leaping higher, spinning faster, charging harder. De Ching was the only monk that the other monks would make a point to watch. Part of it was his skill, and part of it was the joy he exuded, but the major reason was that he was the only monk who consistently improvised new moves for his forms, sometimes on the spot. As great as the other monks were, once you had seen them do the same form, exactly the same way, a couple dozen times, you started to get a little jaded. Not with De Ching. De Ching was once doing his version of Shaolin drunken style, which was created before by a monk with a weakness for the bottle. In the middle of the form, he was supposed to jump into the air, complete a flying kick while rotating in a large parabola before landing flat on the left side of his body. But he had leaped too high, and his body wasn't rotating over fast enough. He was going to crash flat on his back. So what he did was straighten his legs to stop his body's rotation, and then in the middle of the air, 6 feet above the ground, laid out flat as a board, he rotated his hips, which flipped his body like a pancake. When he finally landed, and it seemed like it took a minute, he was in a push-up position, his hands bracing his fall. A monk sitting next to me shook his head with awe and envy and exhaled under his breath, "I wish I was De Ching."
Matthew Polly, reading from American Shaolin. Noah is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Noah. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the chance to speak to you. In 1984, I traveled to China with my master, who was a 33rd generation Shaolin master, and had a chance to be among the first groups to see the resurrection of the Shaolin from its depredations under the communist administration. I appreciated the chance to meet with some Chinese scholars who are adamant that if you take a look at the Age of Peking Man, and I've been given copies of books and reprints of Stone Age weapons that were dug up all over China, that the Chinese were killing each other with weapons for tens of thousands of years before the establishment of the Shaolin Temple. And yet it is legitimate to view the Shaolin Temple as the center of Shaolin Kung Fu for this reason, that when Damo came, and here I differ with your guest as to whether he came from India or from Beijing or by what route, and certainly the first Buddhist temple in China was a white horse pavilion in Luoyang, if you think that's where he came from. But many people, legitimate scholars, believe that what you call Shaolin Kung Fu today as differentiated from the indigenous Chinese martial arts, which are thousands of years older, is that coming from India, they reflect Alexander's introduction of Pancration, or Greek fighting styles, to India. And what we do see is statues from ancient Greece where people are taking stances very similar to what we think of as the spear hand of Shaolin Kung Fu. So in the artwork of Praxiteles from ancient Greece, we can see resurrected in China, say, 1,600 years ago, the evolution of Pancration, which came with Buddhism from India.
No, that's great. You paint a big mural for us, and we can hear that you're into it, and it's terrific. But our time grows short, and I want to come back to Matthew Polly, if I may. There's a bit right at the end of the book where you describe an older man in one of these performances, not a flashy kung fu performer, but kind of acting out, as I read you, Matthew, something essential about Chinese culture. There's not time to read it, but if you could just capture that man, that moment, and the sort of essence of Chinese culture that you saw, some deep strength that you saw on display there.
Exactly. I went back and I saw a performance which was for seniors, which in the kung fu world is anyone over 40. But he was way in his 70s. He had peppered hair. He wore peasant's clothes. He had the rough hands of somebody who'd worked his whole life. And he was performing pudao form, which is a large blade on a staff with a weapon that clearly was a family heirloom. And when I watched him, I realized that he had been doing this form through the warlord period in the 30s, through the Japanese invasion, through Mao Zedong's banning of kung fu, through the Cultural Revolution, and now through this explosive capitalist period. And I think what touched me so much about seeing this was realizing that this was a man who had survived everything and yet had held on to this love and devotion to this one particular art. And in that, it struck me that that represented the strength China has had to survive all of these things and yet still hold on to what is special about their culture.
Well, you convey an awful lot of it to us today. Do you still practice? Are you still out there whirling and twirling and maybe meditating along with it, Matthew?
I do some meditation, and I still practice. In fact, I've been studying other art forms, which is a Shaolin thing to do, and I just got back from Thailand where I was studying Muay Thai. So, and before I was in Rio studying a little jiu-jitsu. So I retain an interest in all forms of martial arts.
It goes on. You've got a great humor right through it as well. And how about your checklist? Ignorance, cowardice, still a boy, not a man, and right on down. How much were you able to check off in Shaolin?
Amazingly enough, I felt like I checked off all the items on the list, and then I discovered new items would pop up. So you improve, and there are still things to do until we pass into the next life.
I guess. Be like water, my friend. Matthew Polly, thanks so much. It's been great having you with us this hour.
Thanks, Tom.
Matthew Polly, his new book is American Shaolin. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.